Right, okay. So I'm going to talk about the program with the Royal Telescope in Cambridge. Mainly I'm going to be talking about H-naught and a bit about the some recent work we've been doing trying to find high redshift clusters. The bulk of the H-naught results I'll be talking about are actually mainly Will Granger's work. He's the current grad student on this, and anyone who was in Toulouse 2 weeks ago will have heard all that before, so you can go back to sleep. So that's the telescope. This is the most benign observing site that's been presented so far in the past few days. This is just a couple of miles down the road from the lab in Cambridge, and the Ryle is basically the four movable aerials and one nearest to them fixed aerial of the old 5 kilometer telescope that originally dates from the early 70s. And in the early 90s, that was upgraded to operate at a relatively high frequency for a wet site like Cambridge of 15 gigahertz, although that's still fine. A bandwidth of 350 megahertz, which was impressive 10 years ago. And the crucial fact is that the shorter spacing at 900 wavelengths meant that the Ryle was the first telescope that could actually make an interferometric observation of the FZ effect. So the typical number here is you get about 200 microjanskis on the single shortest baseline in a 12-hour observation. So this is an east-west synthesis telescope dating from the days when you made your telescopes line up east-west to make the computations more easy. And so you can get a detection of a massive cluster in a couple of weeks. And typically for the H-naught program, we end up spending a few months all in on each cluster. Right. So in common with all the other groups, we've got a lot of stuff to write up, but basically that is the summary of the past few years' work, as far as the radio observations are concerned anyway. I'll go into some detail about a couple of individual recent H-naught observations and some of the details of the method, but the basic outline of the method, I guess, is going to be familiar to everybody here. You need to know the X-ray temperature, and then the combination of X-rays and SZ gives you the line of sight depth through the cluster. And if you have a large enough sample, you can average over the orientations of the clusters. Basically, as Will's thesis, there are three new values of H-naught to add to the existing three that we've already got, so that gives about half a dozen altogether. At the moment, there's about a dozen clusters which we have radio observations of and X-ray data that's good enough to get H-naught, so within the next year or so, we should have a sample of about 12 giving a reasonable value of H-naught from those. Now, I want to discuss a little bit about some of the peculiarities of observing the SZ effects with the Ryle. Certainly the very dominant contaminant, as far as we're concerned, is foreground radio sources, and in fact, in some cases, radio sources within the cluster themselves. And in fact, we use almost all the sensitivity of the entire telescope to get rid of the radio sources. So if you take a look at this, actually, I want to fiddle around with this a little bit. So this is a plot of the the Fourier transform of the brightness in SZ of a cluster. And our shortest baseline is about here. And in fact, really, that ought to be that way around, oughtn't it? So we have a baseline that's relatively sensitive to the SZ effect here, and then the next one is up at about 1800 wavelengths, and then we've got several more out here. And typically, your radio point sources will have fluxes around about this level. And basically, what we do is we use these measurements to estimate the flux of the point sources, subtract it off, and then get the SZ flux itself. So what we're certainly not doing is we're not doing high fidelity imaging. We really only have a single annulus, or a couple of annuli if we're lucky, in the aperture plane with which we measure the SZ effect. And, well, just to sort of illustrate that in real space rather than Fourier space, if you make a map of a cluster region with the entire telescope. So the circle here is the half power point of the primary beam. So effectively, that's an idea of what the field of view is like. You see these individual point sources, and then you have enough sensitivity to remove those in the visibility plane, and you end up with something that looks like that when you use the whole telescope. But then if you go back into the visibility plane and average azimuthally, so what I'm showing here is this is the real part of the visibility is averaged azimuthally and this is the imaginary part. If you were to have a negative source in the center of the field, you'd have zero phase and you'd have negative flux on the shorter spacing. And basically this data point here in almost all the cases is the single data point which we use to fit the SO effect. Now the thing that Will was working on was to make a slight improvement to that method, which is to do it iteratively, including some knowledge of what the cluster is like from X-ray observations. Now the X-ray observations have got much, much better image quality, of course, than we get from the interferometer. So you make a first attempt at describing the shape of the cluster gas by fitting a nice thermal King profile, so you get the position of the cluster and the King profile beta from the X-ray observation, and then you model what the Ryle would see. So you take the Fourier transform of that, take its visibilities, and then simultaneously fit that first stab at the cluster and the point sources in the field by chi-squared minimization. Then you subtract the point sources out of the entire UV data set. Right. It becomes a little bit more complicated if you have a complicated source configuration, or in the case of OO16 especially, there's a slightly variable source. I guess I should highlight the fact that source variability is one thing which certainly the primordial experiments have to worry about a lot, and that's one of the reasons why, especially with BSA, so much effort has been put into trying to do simultaneous source subtraction at the same observing frequency as the primordial fields. So we get our UV data set, and again we use most of the UV data set to determine the fluxes of the point sources, and subtracting those then out from the observation of the cluster, we then take our King profile model of the cluster, whose shape parameters are determined entirely from the X-ray observations, and then we vary the amplitude of the SZ. We vary H0 such that the amplitude of the SZ on our short spacing point is consistent. And typically for an individual cluster, the random errors that we get out are dominated by the flux error on that short spacing SZ data point. Okay, so these are Will's three new maps. The radio contours here are the SZ, and the grayscale is the X-ray image. This is 016, and as you can see, the image quality is not great. I mean, as an interferometrist, one does not want to try and take away any information from that apart from flux and a position with a large error bar on it. Right, and he's also got Abel 990 that's coming as well. And 611 with appropriate individual random error bars on those. Now, one of the other things that Will's done is he has looked into a few of the effects which may cause systematics. And one of the things that's a concern with measuring H0 certainly is orientation of the clusters. We certainly don't know what the line of sight depth through the cluster is just from its projected diameter on the sky. And so to try and determine just how large a sample one needs to average over in order to get rid of that effect. A Monte Carlo simulation was done taking a large number of clusters at random orientations, and then with an input H0 of 50 kilometers per second, the entire observing procedure was simulated. I don't know in detail. Actually, this is does random mean flat between 20 and it's flat between 20 and 120. Yeah. There. The point about this though is that although as you would expect, if you get a cluster which is lying, if you get a very elongated cluster which is lying along the line of sight or in the plane of the sky, you're going to get a relatively small or large value of H0 out from that individual cluster. But the scatter is not actually very great. And so this doesn't cause a systematic effect at all. You know, so the result that came out of this was sort of 49.2 with a 2% error. That was for 50 clusters. So with a sample of 10 clusters, this will give you a 4% random error from the ellipticity. But the thing which was the largest amount of work was actually to try and do a full Monte Carlo simulation using n-body hydro simulations of clusters, which we got from VinSeek. And so these are hydro simulations of individual clusters evolving over time. So we got 10 clusters, and for each cluster, freeze-framed it at an individual redshift, and then observed that large set, doing the entire observing process of simulating the SZ, taking the visibilities out, and then getting a simulated ROSAT image of the same sort of quality that we would have, and putting in H0 of 70, and then trying to get our estimate of H0 out of that. And that gives you an underestimate at about the 10% level, definitely. So that is a systematic effect which we've got to worry about. And another systematic effect, as we've heard already today, clusters are certainly not isothermal. So if you take a real cluster out of one of these simulations, you'll see the temperature going down as you go out in distance. And now certainly with the Ryle, where we're observing at a relatively small angular scale for SZ observations, this gives us a more compact SZ profile. It pushes the flux that we measure. This increases the flux that we measure relative to the mean that you would expect for the whole cluster. So that pushes H0 down as well. So the actual numbers that you want to see, I guess, these are for the three new clusters. And then when you combine these with the three results that we got previously, the geometric mean for an Einstein de Sitter is 59. These don't have the random error bars on them. The random error bars on these are about plus or minus 9 and plus or minus 7, and 54 for a flat lambda. So I would quite happily say that none of these are inconsistent with 60-something. These don't include the systematic errors, no. These have just got random errors in. So we've got good reason to believe that these are maybe sort of 10 or so percent underestimates. Yes. Yes, it does. Because you're preferentially looking more and more at the hotter central bit of the cluster. Yeah, would be less affected. But the lesson that we learned from this is you've just got to Monte Carlo it. You know, you can argue yourself around in circles for years, literally, until you find a grad student who's willing to put the effort into doing it properly. So that's the H-snort. How am I doing? What I'll talk about... am I halfway there? We've heard quite a few arguments already this morning that the SZ effect is a very good way of finding clusters at high redshift. I'll repeat some of the arguments against the traditional methods because I believe in them so strongly. X-rays are always going to be limited, and optical surveys are always going to be limited just by the inverse square law, or by 1 plus Z to the 4th cosmological surface brightness dimming. One important thing that you have to consider is that both of them are going to suffer from Malmquist bias. So you're always going to be preferentially only finding the peak of the population as you go out to higher and higher and higher redshifts. I would argue that if you do an optical cluster survey, depending on your prejudice for what a high redshift optical cluster might look like, you'll tend to find relatively more concentrated things at high redshift. And certainly it's also true that for the X-rays, because you're going as n squared, you're going to find relatively more concentrated things at high redshift. And one other advantage of the SZ effect, which I think can be stated pretty clearly in just a couple of lines, is quite simply that when you observe in SZ effect, your SZ signal just goes as the total energy contained in a cluster, right? You're integrating pressure D line of sight. So you're selecting things by their total energy content. So basically, you are selecting very efficiently by mass. So, as Mike has said in his VSA talk, the RIAL is currently observing flat out doing point source subtraction or point source surveying for the VSA. So during last year, before that program had completely ramped up to 100% of the time, we tried to find a few clusters at high redshift. The science motivations for finding high redshift clusters we've heard in great detail already today. Here's one of our plots for what we think is going to be going. This is just straight Breschecker, and you just see an order of magnitude difference in number counts between. So this is just mass without any further selection put in yet. And you see an order of magnitude difference. That's something that's become pretty well established over the past few years. But what I want to say with this plot is just to highlight that observing in SZ is extremely efficient at finding things at high redshift. Now, what this plot is showing is it's taking ABEL-2218 and showing the flux measured on our shortest baseline with the RIAL as a function of redshift. And so as we push the thing further away from right out in front of, right in front of your face, it decreases in size. So for a given spacing in the interferometry, you get more and more and more flux on that spacing. But as the angular size redshift relation turns over, right, so this is for Einstein's data universe, this plot's a couple of years old when people still believe that, you get a pretty much flat flux versus redshift for a given cluster relationship out to, redshift 10 or whatever. So this is the 5 over 4 and this is where it comes out. So in a flat lambda cosmology, this would just sort of tail up and keep going, something like that. So really what we wanted to do, first of all, at least, was to try and get a test example to show that we could really see things out at about redshift of 1 or so. And it turns out, unfortunately, because we're east-west oriented, we've got very, very little resolution down towards the equator. So 1137 is the only MSS cluster which we can realistically observe. So this bunch of yellow stuff in the middle is the cluster. Now, note carefully that the yellow galaxies in the center are east-west elongated. Right, we've seen a couple of 1 or 2 sigma detections already today, so I've got no shame in putting this up. that's the right way around. Now this is just absolutely booming through in the center. We saw this in a couple of days, because if it's a high redshift X-ray selected thing, it's got to have a gigantic SZ signal. But, yeah, and again, I'll take my radio astronomer's hat off here and I'll look at the map. There's a couple of 2 sigma pixels on either side, east-west here. Right. So this is the sort of thing that you would describe as tentative or tantalizing or provocative in a talk and go no further. But, if you actually look at Douglas Clough's, this is a lensing mass reconstruction, but if you look at the light, again, this is just selecting the galaxies by their color, you see this extension. Now, I would not claim to have detected the filaments coming into either side of this cluster, but I would say that this is a very, very strong argument that instruments with much better imaging ability are needed. Okay, and we've also then tried to find some new clusters at high redshift as far as X-ray astronomers are concerned, I would claim. Perhaps relatively modest cosmological redshift, you know, not out to significantly beyond redshift 1, by using radio sources as signposts. So just as a little bit of radio source physics here, if you have a typical classical double radio source, the synchrotron spectrum is injected with this characteristic spectral index of 0.5 or 0.7 or so. And as a source gets older, the inverse Compton scattering, the synchrotron self-Compton and the inverse Compton scattering cause the spectrum to turn over at high frequencies. Now, this has been known for a very long time, and this is the reason why you can select high redshift radio galaxies very, very efficiently by looking for very, very steep radio spectra, because you're preferentially looking for things which have got high redshift, so they've got very, very significant inverse Compton off the CMB, and you've also got the radio K correction, which pushes the steep part of the spectrum down into a relatively lower observing frequency. Now, we've got nothing like the dynamic range to be able to do this for a very powerful radio source, but if you look at sources that are of order 10 millijanskis or so at NVSS frequency of 1.4 gigahertz, by the time you get to 15, the steep spectrum sources have got fluxes of less than a millijansky, and we can cope with those quite easily. And we have actually successfully managed to detect a couple of clusters. So this is one which was found. This is work done in collaboration with Steve Rawlings in Oxford and Gary Hill in Texas. So this is the short spacing map of the region, of a region which contains a few NVSS radio sources. And from the infrared IDs of the radio sources, so at this level we're talking still all about AGN, and these are, to within a factor of a few, these are reasonable standard candles. So we've got a photometric redshift for this of about 1. And we're also very happy to have found another cluster which is not quite at such an ambitious redshift, perhaps, but this is spectroscopically confirmed now at 0.402, and this is having its velocity dispersion measured at the moment in the optical. So we've definitely got cases where we've got high redshift SZ detections with optical counterparts. Sorry? So those are 90 microjanskis on this one. You know, these are sort of, you know, a bit over half a milli K. This hasn't reproduced especially well. But so these are near infrared images, and so this is the cluster which is, we believe, at about about redshift 1. So the blue dots there are the individual radio galaxies. And apart from that, the field is reasonably blank looking, as you might expect from the cluster. Again, you know, searching in the optical and in the infrared, you really do start to run into great difficulty at about redshift 1. And at redshift of 0.4 here, so here the red contours are the SZ decrement, this bunch of stuff here is a rich cluster, no doubt about it. And then the little blue things are the radio sources. Right. It hasn't all been fun. One thing we also tried was looking at what we thought were the most promising candidates from the HST Medium Deep Survey. And although these numbers aren't especially great yet, and might improve in the course of time, depending on how much observing time we can catch away from the VSA program, it looks as if this might be telling us something about the relative efficiency of just selecting in the optical. You're not necessarily going to find a monster cluster just by looking for a concentration of galaxies in the optical. Right, so... good. So these are the... this is the summary of our high redshift program so far. We've got an absolute thumping detection of a high redshift X-ray selected object, as you might expect. But I will certainly claim that we possibly can see, it's not the cosmic web, but we can see stuff coming out of the center, and we're preferentially much better able to see that in ESA than in X-rays. We've got a couple of secure high redshift ESA detections now with optical counterparts. It may be that something like the cluster mass or temperature is scaling with the number of AGN that you might find in a cluster. You know, this is extremely hand-waving at the moment. But the serious problem with all of this is that the RIAL today is a very, very slow instrument as far as SZ observing is concerned. And certainly with the 13-meter aerials, the primary beam is so small that we just have to always to go for signposts. The conclusion of that, as many, many people now realise, is that you do need an SZ survey telescope, and Mike will be telling us about our plans for that later. Right. You can't measure the position of the center of the cluster accurately with the SZ. Now, nominally, you've got it's about beam size over signal to noise ratio in the radio. But the way we're doing it, you've got to say that my model is the gas that's causing the X-rays is the gas that's causing the SZ decrement. I mean, if you don't believe that, then you can't work out H0 anyway. So we absolutely believe, unless we've got other reason to doubt the X-ray astrometry, we absolutely believe the X-ray position, and we just vary we vary H0 such that the SZ flux then fits. Yep. Well, different experiments suffer from different systematics, certainly. Well, that's it. One thing is that the statistical, the random errors on an individual cluster are so large that, 20 and 80 are usually within one sigma's worth of each other. In terms of the actual visibilities that you get out, yeah, yes. Well, you guys have got better UV coverage anyway, so again, we'd just be saying is what we find consistent with you.
Do you audit the data to get a parameter?
Sorry? No, we don't use the radio data for anything except the amplitude of the decrement. The shape comes out of the X-rays.
Well, especially if you combine the variables. I mean, what you really want is an
SDO measure. Oh yeah, but then you need an aperture that's very well filled. That's ambitious.
Your model fitting to get, once you do the full shape analysis, then you have to get, I mean, the shape that has actually
sure. But at the moment, the total joint